It now gives me great pleasure to introduce my grand sponsor and speaker for this evening. Welcome Victor from Santa Maria.
Hi, Victor.
Hey, Victor.
He said, got home and brought my lunch.
That's a fish.
Because of the grace of God, the love of His children, and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have been sober 33 years. And for this, I am extremely grateful. This is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, therefore, I will not be talking about drugs. Not that I didn't take any, but this is a policy that I was taught, and it's also the one I choose to believe in today. As a matter of fact, I'm not going to talk that much about alcohol either. Not that I didn't drink a lot of that. It was only enough to float a battleship. But I'm most focused mostly on recovery, because I believe that if I'm to leave a message here tonight, I don't want it to be how sad and horrible my life was. I want it to be how rich and full my life is today because of the fellowship of Alcoholics and all Anonymous and all that it entails, especially the four founders. So, I'm getting old, so I make notes. So I follow him. I was born and raised in San Jose, California. It's north of here. At that time, it was a wonderful little town. Now it's just gotten crowded and everything, and drugs and all that stuff goes in it. And I remember as a child, both my parents were field workers, and I felt a considerable amount of shame and feeling lesser than or uncomfortable and embarrassed of them because of that. And I remember I had a lot of friends at that time, and I remember a lot of going to junior high school. We'd meet at different houses, and one time we decided to meet at my house, and my dad wasn't working, and my dad is Filipino, and I was so embarrassed, but they said, we'll just meet at your house until we get together. So there was like about eight of us in there, and he comes in with his pan, and he called it Filipino candy. It was rice and coconut and some brown sugar. It was pretty good, but anyhow, he brings it in, he cut it up, and he starts walking around, my group of friends passing around, and I just wanted to shrivel up and die. It was like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. He's this dirty old Filipino man working in the fields, and he's giving them his grubby candy and stuff. And so we get out, we're walking to school, and at least four of those guys said, wow, that was pretty cool your dad to make that treat. That was pretty good. And so right then I had the tendency of the trait of being so necessary to be sure what people thought about me. It was very important that people not recognize anything bad, but only good things, and how that was unnecessary. It was totally unnecessary, because my friends, they didn't see it that way. They just saw him as a nice old man who was giving them a treat to eat. And so that's one of the traits, and then that escalated into just, I don't know, not looking back, it sounds arrogant, stuff like, but that's the way it was. And so the doctor's opinion, which is really good reading, I found myself, and I think everybody will, especially when he talks about that alcoholics drink for the effect, essentially for the effect. And those it is injurious, they are at times unable, the sensation so elusive that while they can't admit it as injurious, they cannot differentiate the good from the false. For them, their alcoholic life is a normal one. They are restless, irritable, discontent, and they can again feel an experience that comes at ease with comfort with once taking a drink. And though I wasn't drinking heavy at that time, I realized that it was, looking back now, that it was part of like an omen or something, because the first couple of times I drank, like a lot of people here, I just threw up. I couldn't keep it down. It was Olympia beer. I got my sister to buy us a couple of quarts of that. And so I wanted to show off. Yeah. So I drank a whole bunch of it, and then blah, out it came. So I drank some more. I probably ended up maybe taking a half a cup internally. But here's the deal. We're in my backyard, And though I did not get a buzz at all, I acted as though I did. The act of doing that let me know it was okay to act prominent or hot or, you know, arrogant or whatever. And I felt comfortable doing that. And I wasn't even drunk yet. So right away, there's some of the seeds have already been in there and they're just waiting for the real booze to come. And so there was just a wonderful time before it got bad. Usually is out. And I had so much fun with my friends and stuff, like 15, 16, 17. And then I got, like most of the guys, we got married early. It's like, you're what? Ooh, better get married then. And so that happened to me too. And that carried on to that. And then somewhere along the line, it became very obvious that I was very, very domineering and dominant with my family. I like to think I ruled it with an iron fist. It was really bad. And I just felt that was my role. That was my duty. And again, here's where the control come in. I know what's best. If things are done according to what I see, life's going to be good for everybody. Not just me, but everybody. And if you don't know it, trust me. Just trust me on this. And I would do enough good to justify the bad. I'm sure a lot of people relate with that. And so that continued on. And eventually, my first wife just became fed up too much. And so we split ways. And then it got really bad after that. I was just like, I said, okay, it's on now. I can do anything I want. And so I did. And that lasted a couple of years until one day I was drinking and something happened. It was probably one of the worst things that happened to me, and it turned out to be the best thing. I got audited by the IRS, and at that time I was self-employed and I would do my own income tax. And at that year that they wanted to audit me, I was doing what a lot of people refer to as creative math. I just shift a few decimals around here and this and that, and I didn't know that much, and more stayed in my pocket. And that's the year they audited me, and so right away I start thinking these horrible thoughts. Oh my God, they're gonna put me in prison. They're gonna take all my stuff away. What am I gonna do? I can't stand it. So I'm drinking more and more and more. And then one morning I woke up and it could not get drunk. I could not get drunk off of it. By the time I was drinking cheap wine. And so I remember it was so fearful. That fear was so deep ingrained in me at that time that I actually went and got a gun, loaded it, and put it in my lap and thought about ending my life. That's how dark that fear had grasped me. I had allowed that fear to get me. And so, fortunately, I didn't do that. And my ex-wife came over and she said, maybe you should call AA. And okay, and when she said that, I said, but it's not a drinking problem. It's I gotta pay. I might go to prison. She goes, no, look around you. There's empty bottles everywhere and everything. And she said, you drink a lot. And so I was so desperate. I said, okay, whatever, I'll do that. And so that night they sent over they sent over two guys. And they came over and they took me to my first meeting. It was a house meeting, a men's stag, and it was the focus of that meeting was bring a newcomer. It was a wonderful house meeting, and there right off the bat, I had there was divine intervention. I think God had it with all that happening. And also, this is real quick one before I forget. One of the guys, his name was Barry W. I don't think some people remember Barry W. He had a hard time getting sober. He spent like 6-7 years coming in, drinking, going out, coming in, drinking, going out. And he stayed. And the encouragement, and they loved him, and he got to be sober because of that. And he was there at my door. So I one time I thought about that and backed that up, and what if he had come and they hadn't have been so kind and loving towards him? What if they would have shunned him and said, you know what, you're a loser, you're not getting this or anything. He might not have stayed sober. And if that would have happened, he might not have been at that door when I called and answered. And I might not be here. So this the ingrainment of never giving up on another alcoholic, long as they're willing, is deeply, deeply ingrained in me. And all my sponsors felt the same way about that. So I became involved in it, and when I went through the through the audit, and it turns out I just had to pay the late payments and penalties and stuff, and it was okay, you know. And here I was ready to blow my brains out because my mind had just zoomed out there into the bad, which is probably my biggest character defect then and now. But now I have a lot of tools to deal with it. It's not just not even that much close. Kathy asked me today, are you nervous about sharing today? And I said, no, I haven't even thought about it. You know, it's just the next indicated thing, things to do. And I guess I should feel good about that. So that happened, and I became victim of the thing they call complacency. And that went away, and I thought, well, you know, it's okay. I don't have to go to that many meetings. I'm okay now. And some things happened, things came up, and it lasted about a year, and I was off and running again. And so that's when I learned that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. That was a little over a year. I came in 84, and I lasted about a year, a little after 85, then I went out, and in 86 I came back. And I took it more serious, and I took direction, and I just became more involved and more realized how bad this thing can be, that there might not be a next time. And it's still out there floating around. And so, for me, it all centered about turning it over, the third step, in the sense that if I didn't do something about it, something else is going to pop up here in life again. And if I don't have a foundation, it's the same thing that's going to happen. I was convinced of that, and my sponsor helped me to believe that. And so I started listening to cassettes. We had like cassettes back then, and reading stuff. And one of my favorites was Chuck C., who's read A New Pair of Glasses or wonderful, excellent book. He was very popular at this time in 84, and he was different. Speakers were different back then. Well, people remember, if you listen to them now, you would almost say they're kind of boring, you know, because they don't have like the pizzazz that's, I guess, very prevalent and popular now. They just told their story, and sometimes in a droning voice, and so it was just that way. And so for me, Chuck C. stood out because he was just so full of energy and love and enthusiasm and laughter and joy about this whole thing, and I desperately wanted that. So I had four cassettes, a new pair of glasses, and I'd plug it in anytime, any place, and right away it would just lift my spirits. And he got me through my first year, or even the beginning of that, listening to him. And so I remember sharing with my sponsor, this was after maybe a year and a half, that how much I enjoyed listening to the Chuck C. tapes. And I never really shared this before, but I thought it's pretty cool to share the thing. It's about my lineage. And so I told him, I love the part where Chuck C. sitting in the chair and he looks out the window and he says, for 10 years I looked out that window and I hated everything and everybody. He says, now I'm here and it's all heaven. It's all heaven. He says, what has changed? The same wife, same job, same everything. But here I am. He says, inside job. And so I shared that with him, and he said, yes, I have fond memories of sitting in that chair with Chuck and looking at that view. And I looked at him and I go, really? And he says, yeah. He says, I was sponsored by Johnny, I forgot the last name, and Johnny was sponsored by Chuck. So that made Chuck his grand sponsor, and made Chuck C. my great grand sponsor. And I never got to see him because a year later in 85 he passed away. But you can still listen to the tapes and everything. And so Bob was at, we were talking about the same thing about lineage, about that sequence about the chair. And so I remember I looked I was reading it again, New Pair of Glasses. And in the beginning, he talks about that. He says, I sit in my chair now. He goes, some of you have been up there, and I even let a few sit in my chair. And he said, but not for very long. And it just all hit me. He said, yeah, Jim was there, and he got to sit in his chair, and he got the wisdom, and he passed it on to me, and I do the same thing with my guys. And believe they do the same, so that it'll always live on. It never, that essence of pure love and service and humility and joy and laughter, which drew me like a magnet, and to this day still does. Still goes on. And Jim was my first sponsor, and he was like the dad I wished I always had. He was just so loving and nurturing. And I'll share a couple of stories. He taught me a lot of things about the relationship sponsor-sponsee and how important the asset of being responsible and being accountable. One time we had set up an appointment to do some step work. And so I called him up that night and I said, okay, are we still on for tonight? And he says, was that tonight? And I says, yes. And he goes, oh, well, we had, my wife and I had a dinner thing going with some friends. And I said, well, that's okay. And he says, no, I'm going to cancel that. If you're ready to do this, you come over and we'll do this. And he was very adamant about it. And it was like, almost like, this is what we do. You're ready? We're going to do it. And it ingrained a lot of, it just made me love him even more. And like I say, we got very close. I remember, okay, this was 33 years ago, and it just came. My first convention was coming up, and it was in San Luis. They used to have it over there. And there was going to be a dance. And I was all excited about going, but I had a problem. I didn't know how to dance. And it's slow dance. You get me liquored up, and I'm all out there, James Brown, right? Yeah! Rocking out and slow dancing. I didn't know none of that. It was more like just get out there and belly rub and all this, you know. It wasn't really dancing. So I remember I told him, I go, you know, I don't know how to dance. He was a ballroom dancer. He loved to do that. And so he said, I told him, will you teach me? And he looks at me, he goes, you want me to teach you how to dance? And he goes, yeah. I go, yeah, because I got this thing. He goes, okay. So he taught me. We put some music on, we did the box step. Well, simple, just simple little thing. And he taught me how to dance. Matter of fact, today, I was laying my clothes out to get ready to get dressed, and I couldn't find my black shoes. I go, I don't know where I left them somewhere. And the only pair of black shoes there was a pair that Jim had given to me after he passed away. I asked him for it. And so I'm wearing them. They're about two sizes too big. I don't care. I wanted to get it. So I'm standing in his shoes and I'm sharing about him. And it's just, and then he passed away. And then I got, Hank became my sponsor. And then he passed away. And then it was Pete Peterson. And all the men that I've had in my life, they fill that gap that I lacked as a dad. And another thing I learned is that when I was out there, when I was living at home, and afterwards I came, I heard it before, I said, my dad never ever told me he loved me or hugged me. So I get into recovery, and I learned out of inventory, I never told him I loved him or hugged him. So there you go with that, yeah. The step three was so critical, and I want to read something from our 12x12 that for me best describes the way I came in here, and as far as developing a relationship. Okay. Sometimes AA comes harder to those who have lost or rejected faith than those who never had any faith at all. For they think they have tried the way and found it wanting, and they tried both the way of faith and no faith. And this is the dilemma for them. And that's how I was. I decided to do the bargain thing, and God didn't come up with his end. And I'm still in trouble, and all the bad things are happening. Therefore, either God doesn't care about me, or there is no God. So I was mixed up in here, and fortunately, they told me, well, you know, why don't you just start at the beginning here? What would you like your God to be? And I said, well, I'm not sure. And they said, well, what would you like if you could choose? And I remember hearing in meetings that when they referenced their higher power, they said three words always came up: kind, loving, forgiving. And so I said, that's what I would like to see. And they said, well, there's no reason why you can't have that. That can be your higher power. And that was my first introduction to spirituality. And again, they said, because I was confused. I said, well, I tried the church thing and it doesn't work too good for me. And they said, well, it's like this, Victor. Religion is man's organized concept for God, and that works for a lot of folks. Spirituality is man's individual personal relationship with God, as they choose to believe, and that works for a lot of folks. So I remember saying, well, what do you think's best for me? And he said, son, whichever one works for you. And so I've chosen to embrace spirituality. And that's because of that reason. That's what works for me. If religion worked for me, I'd probably be embracing that. But this is what works for me. It's drew me here. And so it brings me to that, to letting go, to just letting go and believing that it's going to be okay. Because again, like I said, one of the biggest defects was, I call it awfulizing, negative projection. There it is. Oh, it's going to be bad. It's going to be bad. But God's got you covered. Yeah, I know, but not on this one. This, you don't know all the details on this one. It's beyond the scope. And so they taught me, well, you know, just go along. Just believe that we believe it's going to be okay. And one of the old timers shared with me, it's like the seemingly good and the seemingly bad. You don't know. You just don't know. It's a story I heard. Chuck Cece said, he said, but two guys meet each other on the street, and one tells the other, how things going? And the guy says, oh, not too good. My mother-in-law moved in with me, and she's a bear. So the guy says, well, that's bad. And the other guy says, well, not really. She gave us a whole bunch of money, and we fixed the whole house up. So the guy says, well, that's really good then. And the other guy says, no, not really. Last night the house burned down. And the guy says, well, then that's really bad. And the other guy says, not really. She burned with it. So anyhow. So then, again, it was just an open mind and a willingness. And if you're here and it's a little bit of an issue still, you haven't got all that God thing, then I'll share what you shared with me. Just don't worry. Don't give it a whole lot of thought right now. Just believe that we believe, and that's enough for now. The rest will take care of itself. And it did. It did. I used to hear him say, and don't do this thing of fake it till you make it. More better, practice it till you make it. So that's what I started doing. And then, of course, it brought us to the number one offender, resentment. And so I learned a lot about that. And the first thing I learned was about praying, to pray for that person. And I remember being in a meeting and hearing that for the first time. And I reached over, I got the book, and I looked. Back then it was page 449 on acceptance, and that helped me a lot too. And what I've done, I've done, knowing that how bad resentment is, I went ahead and did some searching or whatever inventory on my own, and I came up with some of these things that I practice, that I use. You know, affirmations to help with frustration and anger. Before I confront, I will ask myself, are my words kind, are they necessary, or are they true? That's Gussie. I don't remember it's Gussie. Unrequested advice can sometimes be viewed as criticism. I will try to say what I mean, but not say it mean. That's Al-Anon. Allow people their right to be wrong. There is wisdom in the phrase, would you rather be right or happy? To walk away from an argument is not showing weakness. It is to show the strength of one's character. If you want to have good friends, be a good friend. If you want to have a good mate, be a good mate. Never forget to take your problems to God. When in doubt, do the loving thing. There will be times when this action will not please you, but know in your heart it will please your God. Be willing to give people the benefit of the doubt. And I heard a lot one time was this old timer Sherry said, when I let you off the hook, I let me off the hook. And there was a lot of wisdom to that. And so for me, it was I wanted that peace that my sponsor had and Chuck C had. And I found that it requires work. You just can't say, make me good. And poof, you're good. It doesn't work. At least it didn't for me. Okay, in about 8 years into sobriety, the insanity returned and I remarried. Not this one. Let me clear that up. This is number two. Okay. And and it lasted about maybe about three or four years. And she had a little girl, and the little girl was about maybe five or six at that time. And we just bonded really good, really good. And we hit it off, and I used to help her with basketball, and we just had so much fun. Some of the people are Sue members, Jenny, little Jenny, okay. So we ended up having to go part our separate ways, and she moved up north. And so we Jenny and I kept in touch. I went down there for her graduation, and as time happens, we lost touch of each other, and many years passed by. And then about maybe about 3 years ago, I get a phone call from her, and we start talking and talking and stuff. And she goes, "I have something to tell you." And I go, "What's that?" She goes, "I'm an alcoholic and I've been sober 7 years." And so we talked for another hour and a half after that. And it turns out we just developed this wonderful, wonderful relationship that got rekindled, like, and so a couple months ago, we had planned a trip up north to go visit my sister in Oregon, and Jenny lives right along the way, on the way up to Fortuna. So we stopped off there, and we spent a couple of days with her and her beautiful family, and we just, it was like we just picked up where we left off, and it was just a really wonderful experience, and she's going to come down this way, take her kids to Disneyland next year, and then she can stay with us for a while. And that and she called at a time in my life where there was a lot of difficulty in my life. There were things going on that were just some turmoil, some trauma. And so it was like a breath of fresh air. It was like God said, "I'm going to give you this, help you out a little bit, Vic, on this." And I believe that that's just how God works in my life. And so then I just became involved in recovery and embraced it even more, and never really got romantic involved again until number three. And Kathy was a normie, and we had met through this group of people, mutual friends and stuff, and so we dated a couple of years, and then we decided to tie the knot. And so we went to Hawaii for our honeymoon, and while I was over there, I guess the honeymoon got a little out of hand, and I had a heart attack. So, for real, yeah. And so it became necessary to have a step procedure done on there. And Kathy's over there, "Yep, that's me. So I'm laying there, and they schedule me. They said, "We got to do it here. We got a big blockage." And so I had to spend one night in the hospital myself. And the next day when Kathy came, I told her, "You need to call AA for me and tell them to send somebody over here." And she goes, "Okay." So she called, and I told her, "I hope they sent a really crazy guy, because I'm in a bad place right now." So about a couple hours later, in walks this guy. He's a big, tall guy, and he's got a Hawaiian shirt on. He's got a beard, and he's long gray hair. And he goes, "Hey, I hear you got some problems going on." And so he explained, "Yeah, I'm going to have surgery. I got to have a heart attack." He goes, "Really now?" It's another God shot. So he opens up his shirt, and he has a scar from here to here. He had open heart the old school way, where they used to go in there. And I looked at it, and I go, "You didn't know?" And he goes, "No, they just told me some goofy guy's over here and need some help. So here I am." So we hit it off, let's say, and first thing he did was, let's pray. So we knelt down and we prayed. And then they brought a meeting to me that night. And there was about, oh, must have been about 12 guys in the room. And so they were laughing, and it's just real good meeting. The next day, they take me into to the William Ian and the cart for the surgery. And I remember still a little nervous, and it was my next door neighbor was this lady who I thought was just really grumpy. She wouldn't say hi. She wouldn't just, she just seemed that way. And so we go and by her, and I just kind of looked at her, and she looked at me, and she went like that. And I said, okay, it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. So the surgery gets started, and then it went pretty good. And then I find out later that Kathy shared me that she was in the room, and a lady walked in, and she says, are you Kathy? And Kathy says, yes. She goes, I'm from Al-Anon. I'm going to stay here with you through his through your husband's surgery. And Kathy had no idea what Al-Anon was, or you know, what consisted of, or anything. She just knew that some strange lady was willing to sit with her while she went through this trauma. She was not going to sit alone. And so it went well. And then afterwards, we were talking about it. This was like the second or third day before we were going to go. So we had no place to go. We couldn't make reservations. And one of the ladies said, it's taken care of. She said, everything's taken care of. You have to stay two more days to make sure the sutures don't open. So then a guy came in a cab, and he goes, he shuts the thing down. He goes, I'm a friend of Bill's. He said, this one's on the house. So he drives us to the hotel. Then he gives us our room. And they take us up to a suite. We've never been in a suite before. It has a big couch and all this beautiful view and everything. And we stayed there for, I think, two or three more days. And we went to meetings and stuff. And it was just, I just felt very grateful. Kathy was overwhelmed. She goes, those people don't even know you. So this is what they do. And I go, it's a fellowship. And Al-Anon too. And so we came home and she got dove right into Al-Anon. She started meeting at her house, and then she just became more involved and just in recovery in general. She's embraced it so much since then. And you know, I think that sometimes I wonder, why do I have such a wonderful marriage? And I say I don't think I deserve this sometimes. I really feel that way. But then I say, it's what's happening. If it's what's happening, then I go with it. Just go with the flow and be grateful. Just be grateful, gracious, and be the person I feel God would have me be, the person that God, Kathy thinks I am, because obviously that's part of it. No, that I am. Okay. And that takes care of that. And like I said, if you want a good mate, be a good mate. And I've learned them. If there's any rules, I would say, or guidelines, the number one would be don't keep score. Don't keep score of anything. Because then you're getting into the bargain stage. Well, I did this, and so I knew that. We just roll it, and it turns out okay. It turns out good. And so where are we at? Okay, gratitude. Well, first, the resentment, and then after that, I'm real big on step 10. Continue to take personal inventory of wrong, promptly admitted it. For me, it's a gauge of how I'm doing in recovery. If I can be honest enough that I have genuinely stepped on somebody's toes or done something inappropriate, wrong, then I need to make it right by not just owning up to my sponsor or somebody close, but I believe, and this it says in the, I read what it says here, it alludes to it, step 10, that after we do that, okay, as we glance, okay, when prideful anger, anger, jealousy, or fear, we acted accordingly, and that was that. Here we need only recognize that we did act or think badly, try to visualize how we might have done better, and resolve with God's help to carry these lessons over into tomorrow, making, of course, any amends still neglected. So they're alluding that it's not just saying you're sorry or I did this thing, but taking a step further to not have it happen again. And so that's why I'm big step 10. And I think that's probably what keeps me in line the most, is honoring that step. A lot of times we don't want to do that because we know it's going to mean giving something up we like or something, or we're going to lose on something. But in the end, it all turns out good. So, okay, gifts that I've received. Some people, they say, I'm so grateful for all the gifts I received in AA. And but they don't get into it into detail. And so I'm going to share with you what are the gifts that I've received that just warm my heart and make me grateful that I came, truly grateful this day. Not just staying sober and now I'm not going to have to go to jail or stuff like that. But it's because alcohol is it's a symptom. It only talks about alcohol in the first half, first step. The rest is about life and change. And aside from, we already heard about my marriage, that's in all other relationships, rekindling with my kids. I remember I did my first amends with my kids. They were small. And I don't think they understood the whole concept of it, but I went through the process. I just said, basically, I was a bad dad. I'm sorry I did that. And I'll try to be better now. And they kind of just said, okay. So time goes by, and I start reflecting on that. And every time they would say, this was happening up until maybe 17 years of sobriety, I would hear the promises, and I would hear, we would not regret the past. And I would cringe every time they said that. And I said, that's a bunch of bullshit. If I could go back and change the bad father I was for those kids, I would do it in a heartbeat. I would do it. I would do it to make, so I wouldn't have to feel the way I am now. And so at the time I had my sponsor in Morro Bay, PP, and his policy was to do a step a month, and every month we do a different, just move on. And so when I started doing, ready to do step eight, I told him, I shared, you know, I still have some guilt and remorse about the father I was. I spanked when I should have yelled. I yelled when I should have talked. I talked when I should have listened. I was not a good father. I didn't understand that was bad, and there's a better way, a healthy way, a godly way. And so he said, well, you know, if it bothers you that much, then you might think about redoing that. So I thought about that, and I said, maybe that's what I need to do. And so I made arrangements with him. This was maybe 10 years ago. And I told him, I need to talk to you individually. And I shared with my son how I regretted so much the way how bad I was with him and stuff, and some specific incidents. And I thought he was just going to say, oh, that's okay, I don't even remember it. He said, oh yeah, Dad, I remember those times. He said, I remember a lot of the times. And I said, well, let's talk about it. Whatever you got to do, get it. This now is the time. And he said, well, Dad, to be honest with you, the best times of my life were with you, and some of the worst times of my life were with you. He said, but you're a different man today. He said, so it's all water under the bridge. And he closed the book, and I never had to look back or feel guilt remorse about that again, unless I choose to. So I did the same with my daughter, and the same result too. She remembered everything. And she said, well, you're doing so much better. She was more worried about her brother. My son took the brunt of it, I guess, because I expectations or whatever. So that's helped me to be healed of that. And I have faith in this. If anything comes up again, I know what I need to do. I need to share it with somebody else and then talk to God about what to do, corrective measures. Again, step 10. And then that, and then also my home group is a Madman's step study meeting. We meet here every Wednesday at 7. And there's about maybe a dozen regulars that go there. And we have a mixed group. We have guys with just under a year, and then we have guys with like 2 or 3 years, and then we have some old timers. And so it's a nice mixed group, and I feel so good at that meeting because I feel that in some small way I'm contributing to the wisdom and knowledge that these young guys are striving to understand and embrace and incorporate in their lives. I feel like we are doing our part, and Billy and these old timers, we're doing our part to ensure that the recovery stays good and pure and the way it was meant to be, to always be. And I feel grateful that I have that opportunity. It's a blessing. It's a blessing. And then another thing that just warms my heart when I think about it. One of the guys I sponsor, he's almost 80, and he's got like 38 years of sobriety. And he's confined to a facility that he's probably not gonna leave that. He can't because of guidelines they have and everything. So anyhow, a couple months ago, he says, "Hey, I want to work the steps again." And I said, sure, Jim, we can do that. And then I thought for a minute, and I go, well, just curious, what's your motivation for wanting to do this? And he looked at me and he said, "I want to be a better person. I get to be a part of that. I get to experience that in my life." And again, like my marriage, sometimes I wonder, I just feel overwhelmed and so I just try to be gracious. Be gracious. When people tell me, "Well, I don't want it. I can't do that. I can't take that from this," I say, "Be gracious. Learn to be gracious. If somebody wants to give you something, it's because they really want to. And to turn that down is like saying, well, you don't matter. My pride counts more. I know it'll make you feel good. It's not." So I've learned how to be gracious and how to be, to give with neither the desire to accept anything from that, nor just no desire to. Sufficient that God and I know about this act that I'm doing. Sufficient. And this, I feel this has made me, help mold me into the man I try to be, the man who's trying to share this message with you today. And so if I am to share any specific, it'd be to work the steps and good sponsorship and give it away. Give it away. Sometimes maybe we don't have enough time, we think, or we're not ready or like that. There's other ways. Just being kind to a newcomer is paramount. In our group it's small, so there's no little bunch of clicks here and there. We're all one click. And so if somebody's new in there, he gets introduced right away. He can have a sponsor right then and there if he wants. We get him a book. We get him on the path in a personal, strong, healthy manner with love. And we check on each other. I remember when I was brought in, it was the sponsorship was there was a sponsor and then his sponsee and then the sponsees, and they would all intertwine though. It always intertwined. And I see that in our group, and I try to carry that message to other people too. If you're a sponsor, then at least personally, you should know your grand sponsees and a little bit about their lives and what's going on with them. I just feel that's the way it should be. That's the way it brought me in. That's the way I was brought in, and so I try to carry that message too, and just the willingness to help another person. How paramount this is! I had my first slip in 85. My sponsor called and he says, "I don't see your meetings anymore." And I said, "Well, you know, this thing's just not working for me. It's not for me." And he said it. I'll never forget it. He said, "But you never even helped anybody." And he said it with the focus that if somebody's drowning in the water and you throw him a life preserver and he doesn't even take the life preserver, he just paddles over here and then drops down and dies and drowns. That's what he said. And then later on, I understood what he meant. And the first direction he ever gave me was, he says, "Vic, you just got to do two things. He says, don't drink and be willing to help another human being." He didn't say alcoholic. He said human being. And so, and from that, I understood that we take it, we may discover it in these rooms and nurture it, but we practice it outside anywhere. Responsibility pledge.
Yeah.
When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always be there, and for that I am responsible. And so I do to the best of my abilities. I try to practice that, and just be willing, I guess, you know. And I feel that I'm the luckiest man in the world. I wouldn't trade my life with anybody at any time. And when I came in here, I would have traded my life with anyone's life, sight unseen. That's how horrible my life was, and how I felt about it at that time. And so if you're new, please give this thing a chance. You may not understand what's going on. You may not agree with all the things shared. But there's one fact you can't get away from, and that's that we're here, we're sober, and for the most part, happy and content with our lives as we are. So please keep coming back. I love you. May God bless. Well, I went by fast.
You did.
Me.
Yeah.
I hope it didn't drag for anybody else.
Yeah, it did.
All right, let's have another round of applause for Victor.